from San Francisco, welcome to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, with your interview host, Dr. Moira Gunn.
If we had already done the research and we knew exactly what sensor Mondavi needed, they could go out to the commercial segment and purchase either satellite data or aircraft data to solve their problem. But the fact is, no one has used remote sensing for this particular problem.
How long does it take for advanced research sponsored by the federal government to eventually benefit the rest of us? In this case, no time at all. On today's show, Moira speaks with Joan Salut, manager of NASA's Grapes Project, and Phil Fries, vice president for wine growing at Robert Mondavi Winery. They talk about the partnership between NASA and private industry, which is designed to address the massive infestation of the disease phylloxera, which is now affecting the $10 billion California wine industry.
This design is designed toward a 5 percentile North American female hand size up to a 95 percentile North American male. And those are what product designers try to design products to.
Cliff Brooks is the project manager for Microsoft's new mouse. How did Microsoft design this mouse? How can it possibly be that much different from their old mouse? And how did they test it? Now, here's Moira with Joan Salut and Phil Fries.
What is phylloxera, and how do you spell it?
Well, phylloxera is spelled much like it sounds. It's P-H-Y-L-L-O-X-E-R-A. And it really refers to, in its Greek term, about the infestation or the effect that it has on the vines or a plant that causes it to decline, and the leaves wither up and fall off and the vine dies, because phylloxera feeds on the roots. And it's an aphid-like insect that lives under the ground and produces young in a stage where there are only females that lay eggs, and the eggs hatch and they go through developmental stages and lay more eggs. And they build up very quickly, and in the build-up, they feed on the roots and eventually then prevent the roots from taking up nutrients and water for the vine and then cause them to die.
How prevalent is phylloxera?
Well, it's our concern, and why we're talking about this now, is that phylloxera has appeared in California again almost 100 years after it devastated the wine grapes of California. Approximately in the late 1800s, 1870s to 1890s. And today, why we're concerned about phylloxera is it seems to be coming back. And it's coming back in a form that's very robust. It produces more young, lays more eggs, and more eggs survive into adults and lay more eggs. And so it's more aggressive. And it's very prevalent now, and that's the reason we're working on this project, is to find out exactly how fast it's spreading through California and through our vineyards. But it was first discovered in Napa in the mid-1980s, nearly 100 years after the declines of the 1800s. And it seems to be spreading very rapidly now, this more aggressive, more robust form. And so that's what our project is part of it, a very big part of it, is to track and see how fast it's moving.
Now, what happens when a plant, or a vine, I guess as you would call it, gets phylloxera? Does it just produce less grapes or worse grapes? What happens?
Well, a number of things happen to it, but the principal one is that as the phylloxera feeds on on the roots, then the roots become inactive. They start to have some scar tissue on them, and you can imagine as you were pruning these roots off effectively, then the vine has less and less capacity to carry fruit. So it does both. It produces less crop, but also the fruit that it does produce is not as high quality. And so because of this, then we lose the production from these vines very quickly. Not necessarily that the vines don't produce any crop, but that the crop that they do produce we can't use.
How long would a healthy vine from the time it first started producing to its natural life without phylloxera, how many years would that be?
Well, we estimate they last somewhere around 30 years. Now, we have vineyards that are 50 years old and still producing in our own vineyards at Robert Mondavi Winery. And there are a number of vineyards around California that may be bordering on 100 years. But the norm in a commercial vineyard, we use approximately 30 years.
Joan, now how did NASA get involved here?
Well, NASA has some technology that's been maturing over the last 20 or so years that is used in agricultural and can detect stress. And we were looking for commercial partners to help spin off our technology, take it out of the hands of researchers, and put it in the hands of people who can use it to solve problems for their own business purposes, to help with their profit line.
So what are you going to do with Robert Mondavi?
We're going to team up and jointly conduct some research and also apply some techniques that we're very, very familiar with to help them solve their problem. The technology we'll be using is called remote sensing, and what that is, it's electronic scanners that measure reflectance in different parts of the electromagnetic spectrum. Our eyes, we see in the visible region, but these scanners can measure the reflectance in the near-infrared, and some of the scanners can measure in the thermal region. So we'll be using our electronic scanners to measure the reflectance off of their vines.
So you're going to be looking at fields and see, obviously you can see the visual spectrum, but also see the thermal that's coming off of it and any infrared sources.
Right. The scanners will see things that we can't see. And some of these scanners are actually field-based, in the field, in your hands, pointed at the vine, measuring real up close. Some of them will be mounted on aircraft, low-flying and high-flying aircraft, and we'll also be using satellite data. Satellites have scanners that work on the same philosophies, but you're able to see a much larger region of the Earth's surface.
And you mentioned stress. A plant that has a vine that has phylloxera is under stress? I mean, as a system?
Yes, it is. And it's stressed because the roots aren't functional and or impaired in their function. And so what Joan is describing is going earlier than we can see the visual symptoms, where we can walk into a vineyard and we see vines that are starting to decline. What Joan is describing is using this very sophisticated reflectance measuring at specific wavelengths to look at certain compounds that may be in those leaves that are early indicators of stress. Because the roots are not functional, then the vine is under some kind of stress. It's moisture or low nutrient uptake or some physical kind of stress. And the scanners that she's talking about, very sophisticated ways of taking a look at some of those organic molecules that are inside those leaves.
How long between the time phylloxera finds its way to a root of a vine and the time it really takes it over and you're able to see that it's that something's wrong here?
Mm-hmm. That's a really good question, and I'm not sure we know an answer to that because it depends a lot on several things, like how hard we're making the vine work. If it's producing more crop, it may decline more rapidly. It seems like in some soils, the vines decline more rapidly than they do in other soils. And curiously enough, it may be in some of our very best or richest soils that the vines decline more rapidly, I think because the vines are used to carrying a little bit more crop and also having a very extensive root system. And in those cases, we use the number of about 3 years. And of course, we don't know exactly when a vine is infested with phylloxera. And a lot has to do with how rapidly the phylloxera builds up on those roots and how fast they're producing young that are then feeding on the roots. But for rule of thumb, we usually use around 3 years.
So obviously, let's just say an average of 3 years, but we really don't know, mm-hmm. and we probably will know a lot more after this experiment.
Well, that's one of the beautiful things about this experiment, because some of the subject areas are areas that don't have phylloxera yet at all, but they're high-risk areas, and because they're adjacent to areas that do have phylloxera, and we know that phylloxera tends to spread somewhat like the ripples of a pebble in the pond, and it spreads outward. And then what we're going to attempt to do is to watch some of these vines that don't have phylloxera yet, and we dig up their roots and we look at them and make sure we can't find any phylloxera, but continue to watch those, and assuming that they're going to become infected during the course of this trial and in the course of the trials that we're running right now, then we'll be able to see what those early indicators of phylloxera stress really are.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to TechNation, Americans and Technology. I'm Dr. Moira Gunn, and my guests today are Joan Salute, manager of NASA's Grape Project, and Phil Fries, vice president for wine growing at Robert Mondavi Winery. How does the phylloxera spread from field to field?
Well, again, that's a very good question, and it happens to be one of our goals in this experiment. We think that there may be some real simple methods that are local spread, and that is in the soil from vine to vine, the phylloxera may move in many of our soils in California as they dry during the summertime. They tend to crack slightly, even minutely, and I liken those to phylloxera freeways, because the phylloxera isn't very effective at burrowing through the soil, but if there's any kind of airspace in the soil, then I think the phylloxera can move along those open spaces and find another vine. But what about in the larger sense, the macro sense of from site to site, from vineyard to vineyard, or from now we know we have phylloxera in Napa, and we saw it in Sonoma, now it's in Lake County, it's moving down into the area around the San Francisco Bay, it's in San Joaquin Valley now. And how does phylloxera move there? And I think there are really two questions. One is it moving? And if it is, it has to be some physical method of moving soil or moving something that's contaminated with soil that may have phylloxera associated with it. For example, if we're moving vines from one site to another and they had phylloxera on the roots and then they were planted again in the new site, then we would have phylloxera established in the soil. But there's also another question, and that is, I've referred to the new phylloxera that we have, and it's really not new. It's a selection of a phylloxera that's probably been around for a long time. And what we may be seeing is that this new type of phylloxera is a natural selection process. And it may not be moving at all. That is, it may be there already, but just hasn't been expressed yet. And we can't really answer either one of those questions definitively until we get to this project. And with the help of NASA and with the sophisticated remote sensing, what we're hoping we can do is to watch and see if in new sites there is one spot that would be indicate that there was one spot of phylloxera, maybe it was introduced, and then it spreads out from there, or do we see a number of spots show up perhaps all at the same time? And these techniques will allow us to look at a large surface area of the state of California very, very quickly with these very sophisticated high-altitude remote sensors and try to see if there are individual spots showing up or single points.
What's so wonderful about this project is that we're not saying, well, here's something, we now have a better Band-Aid to put on it. We're going to learn a lot about how things are because information is available that truly wasn't available before. And so that has a, exactly. As a technologist, warms my heart.
It truly is applied research.
Truly.
It's for a specific problem, but there's lots of questions that we don't know the answers to yet, and we'll be learning those answers together.
Now let me get into the technology. I had to find all about these vines here. First of all, let's start with the handheld scanners. You know, are they the size of a remote control for your television set, or what are we talking about?
More like a large camera mounted on a tripod. I think that'd be the best comparison that most people are familiar with.
And will you walk up to just the leaves, or do you dig up the roots, or what do you do?
Well, we have a whole team of scientists out there. Some of our colleagues from the different universities will be digging up the roots because we need to know whether or not the phylloxera is present. Our scientists from NASA Ames will be focused on looking at the leaves and looking at the vines and looking at the canopy, which is the collection of leaves and vines.
Often in remote sensing, any of the satellite sensing, you not only get what the disease is or the stress condition or the problem condition, but you also have to get your normal reading so you know what you're looking at. How do you know what you're looking at? Is that part of that?
Well, part of the experiment is to look at healthy vines that we know for sure do not have phylloxera, and the only way we'll know that is by digging up the roots. Healthy vines are vines that don't have phylloxera but have some other stress condition.
Mm-hmm.
And then vines that we know have phylloxera and look good, and vines that we know have phylloxera but don't look good or are already showing the symptoms. So there's four different categories of vines that we'll be repeating the same experiments with.
Mm-hmm.
And one aspect of the experiment is to take leaf samples and grind them up and send them to the lab for nutrient analysis. And that way we can be sure what the reflectance signatures are telling us.
What you're doing is you're taking sort of a monitor and you're walking up to the leaves and the roots and all that type of thing, and you're getting signatures, as we call it, on each of those four categories. Okay, now that's in walking around on your in through the fields, and then right. we're having low flying aircraft.
Correct.
And having high flying. Now is the difference Correct. Just let's see if we can see it high and let's see if we can see it low, or
that's part of it. With the low flying aircraft, the resolution will be 2 to 3 meters, so we'll just get a couple of vines, like the what's called a pixel, the smallest. Spot on the ground that we can get information on uh-huh. would be 2 to 3 meters large. But then when you back up and you go to the higher flying aircraft, it might be 30 meters. Different components of the project need different scales of information. For the specific phylloxera spots, they start off very, very small. But then when a whole field goes, obviously you can see it on a field-wide basis, and we need to take a look from up higher. With the satellite data, we'll be looking at the whole entire valley. How many fields have they already lost to phylloxera? We have baseline data from the mid-'80s, before the problem was widespread, and we'll be calculating how many acres of vineyards they had then. And like every year or every other year, we'll make new measurements by buying historical data that was collected throughout the 80s and early 90s, and we'll look each year to see how many acres were lost.
So that this experiment itself will, in fact, support all the wine growers in the Napa Valley.
The information will definitely support all of the wine growers. It was never intended just to be information for Robert Mondavi Winery. They're our partner, and they're funding part of the work, but the information will definitely be public information.
And, Margaret, I'd interject that this information is necessary and will be taken out to the entire state and all the areas that grow grapes, and especially wine grapes as we're looking at them. So the technology needs to be developed very quickly and needs to be taken out into application very quickly. As I indicated, now we've moved out of the Napa and Sonoma areas with phylloxera and into, I think there are 7 counties now that have phylloxera. And that total area represents about 30%, potentially 30% of all the wine production in the state of California.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Dr. Moira Gunn, and my guests today are Joan Salute, manager of NASA's Grape Project, and Phil Fries, vice president for wine growing at Robert Mondavi Winery. Tell us, what does grapes stand for, and what are all the various projects within the project?
GRAPES is the acronym that represents Grapevine Remote Sensing Analysis of Phylloxera Early Stress. And we're quite proud of that because a lot of times acronyms don't readily mean anything, but we really like the title of this project. We're pleased with that. The overall project has 4 distinct tasks. The first task is very research-oriented. We want to see if, with remote sensing technology, we can detect phylloxera in its pre-visual stage. As we've mentioned earlier, after approximately 3 years, you can walk into the field and see with your eyes that these vines are struggling or dying. But what we want to do with the sensors is see the reflectance response in regions that we can't see with our own eyes and detect it in the pre-visual stage. So that's the first task, and it's the most research-oriented task. The second task, which is extremely important for the overall understanding, is utilizing a geographic information system, which is abbreviated GIS, and we call it that a lot. We're going to use a GIS to study the land and look at all the different factors that contribute to the phylloxera sites. What's going on in the actual field in terms of soil type, what the field was used for. Maybe a few years ago it had a different land use, which contributed to the habitability for the phylloxera. What's going on in neighboring land use areas? So we take a bigger picture. We look at all the different components of the environment. The third task is to look back historically from the mid-'80s till now to see how many acres or fields of vineyards have been lost to this epidemic. As Phil can explain better, some companies are going out of business. They're just ripping out their vineyards, and they're not replanting because of the financial aspects. And we want to see what really has been the effect of this epidemic in the last 7 or 8 years. The fourth task is to look back and try to see how phylloxera spread. Did it come in one spot and grow? Did it come in a whole bunch of spots simultaneously and spread from each of those spots? To try to understand the spread dynamics. And this will be useful for this epidemic, but will also be useful for them to understand future problems.
Now, what satellite are you using? just one of those ones you have laying around,
yeah,
Joan?
Yeah. The primary satellites that we'll be depending on are the Landsat Thematic Mapper Sensor and the French SPOT system.
Are those all on the same satellite?
No.
Those two different
SPOT is a satellite, and Landsat is another satellite.
Are both of those U.S. satellites?
SPOT is put up by the French.
By the French. Well, tell us, where are they? Are they scanning? Are they running over California? Are they stationary? Where are they?
They in a geosynchronous orbit. I think that's the right word. geosynchronous, that's correct.
The person from NASA doesn't know. I like that. This is good radio.
I'm not an orbital mechanic. I started to say geostationary, and that would definitely be wrong. It covers all the land surface, and it repeats over the Landsat system, for example, repeats over any given spot every 16 days. Mm. So it continually circling around, and it comes back to a particular spot every 16 days.
So you can basically cover the whole globe.
That's correct.
With the Landsat. You just say, it's coming up, let's start collecting data
right.
of our spot, and if you miss it, then you got to come back 16 days later.
That's right, or if you have clouds. Actually, SPOT is more complicated than that because not only does it look straight down, but it looks at angles depending on where you tell it to look. So if you're looking at a further angle, you can get repeat coverage every 4 or 5 or 3 days. But if you're looking straight down, it's every 14 days. So there's not a simple answer to that part of the question.
Now, do they collect different types of data?
Yeah.
What different types of data do they
collect? Oh, between the two satellites?
Yeah.
Very similar. The Landsat Thematic Mapper Scanner has 7 bands, and what that means is in 7 distinct regions of the electromagnetic spectrum, it makes a measurement. The SPOT system has 3 bands.
Mm-hmm.
The SPOT system can measure at the 15-meter pixel size. Landsat's at the 30-meter pixel size.
Mm. But I'm just wondering why you need the second system.
Because it's available, because it will have different days of coverage. Landsat may fly over when it's completely cloudy. Those systems cannot see through the clouds. But if SPOT came 2 days later and there weren't any clouds, then we'd want that data.
So you can't collect through the clouds.
No, not with these sensors. And the other thing is, since they do have different resolutions in different band regions, mm-hmm. we don't know which is going to be the best for this problem yet.
Aha,
we
research.
Want to try both.
Let's see. Let's get the data and see what we have. You were saying... In the late 1800s, what happened with Phylloxera?
Mm-hmm. Well, Phylloxera is a really interesting bug in the sense that it's native. It appears to be native to the eastern and the southern parts of the United States. And it's native in the sense that there are a lot of wild grapevines that grow in those areas. And Phylloxera and grapevines have learned to live together so that the Phylloxera lives on the grapevines but doesn't kill the grapevines. So we call those tolerant. And those vines tolerated Phylloxera in very low levels, and they continued to live very happily. About the 1860s or so, some French scientists had observed that they were having some difficulties, some disease problems in France, and were traveling around the world looking for natural sources of resistance. Curiously enough, it wasn't Phylloxera. They didn't know about Phylloxera at that point in time. What they were looking for was resistance to a particular fungus that grows on the grapevines, on the leaves. They saw that in the southern part and the eastern parts of the United States, grapevines grew in very humid, in the southeastern, the seaboard states there, grew in the presence of conditions that were much similar to the ones that they had in some areas of France, did not have the fungus on them, and they assumed that these grapevines had some natural resistance. The temptation was very strong. They succumbed to it. They took grapevine material back to France, and most likely they transported Phylloxera with them, unbeknownst to them. Well, Phylloxera managed to establish itself and marched through much of Europe and destroyed the European, in particular the French, wine industry. At an almost sequentially or almost temporally the same time, grapevine material was moved probably from the Midwest and the southeastern states to the state of California and was established because people were looking for new types of grapes to grow in California. I think similarly, almost at the same time, we got Phylloxera in California. And Phylloxera takes a while to build up in population, but when it builds up, it's like a real raging fire. And then, so Phylloxera spread through at almost the same times through Europe in the late 1800s and through California. The Europeans were very aggressive, and the French in particular finally stumbled on, and they took two courses. One was of trying to find sort of snake oils, as I call them, were mysterious ways of combinations of chemicals and other magic that they thought would rid the vines of this pest. And they weren't sure what the pest was. They didn't really understand the biology. Some of the other scientists said, look, it's an aphid-like insect that lives on the vines, it destroys the roots, and these grapevines that we brought over for resistance to this fungal growth on the leaves also have natural resistance to phylloxera because of their root system. And that was called the American camp. And so there were two splits, the one I call the snake oil and the other one the Americans. And the American camp was greatly in disfavor. And it was only after a lot of work that people showed that there really were two methods of controlling phylloxera. One is to flood the vineyards for 40 days and 40 nights. And I use that number. It's somewhere between 30 and 60. But 40 days
good,
and 40
though.
Nights.
It's very good.
Flooding the vineyard seems to suppress phylloxera. And the other course was to replant the vines onto these new American rootstocks. Now, unfortunately, what we'd done in California and the nuance in this story is that we had chosen to use a stock that was not as resistant to phylloxera as it really should have been. And we knew that, because it had a little bit of the parent type, we call the Scion type that produces Cabernet and Chardonnay and so forth. That type, that French type that's very susceptible to phylloxera when it's planted directly, if one takes a cutting and sticks it in the ground, and it will grow. Those cuttings are not resistant to phylloxera. However, as I said, the American stocks are. We used a cross that had the European stock and the American stock as a genetic cross, and it looked to have very favorable conditions for as a rootstock. It was easy to grow. It was very easy to graft, as we graft a Cabernet or a Chardonnay onto it. It was almost impossible to kill it
okay.
in the sense of horticulture, and it was very productive. And that stock was used very extensively until the current time, as I say, until the mid-1980s in California. Well, then what we started to realize is that the phylloxera had become adapted to feeding on this stock that had part wild American rootstock and part European stock. And that parentage left a chink in its armor, and phylloxera figured out how to grow on it. So it adapted to this population that we had put out here in the fields. And that's what our decline is now.
Does the involvement of NASA bring a project like this to a head faster, or could private industry do this by itself?
Okay, if we had already done the research and we knew exactly what sensor Mondavi needed, they could go out to the commercial segment and purchase either satellite data or aircraft data to solve their problem. But the fact is, no one has used remote sensing for this particular problem. It has been used in many different agricultural applications, but not in this problem. We don't know how this infestation is going to manifest itself. So we're going to be bringing a whole different suite of sensors to the problem. And we're going to be bringing researchers who have experience with these different sensors towards their problem. And we're going to work together. They're going to explain to us what they think will be happening, and then we're going to be going out there and measuring it. Without our partnership, they wouldn't know what to ask for from the commercial segment. And to purchase everything, it wouldn't be possible for them to access the scanners that we have available to us.
So this is a good example of the research facilities and the research capabilities of government being brought to bear to bring a simple solution so that industry can take advantage of it.
Exactly, except for maybe the word simple.
That's the way it is at NASA.
Not exactly simple. But yes, we're going to be making our research tools and our research scientists available to them for their problem.
Moira's guests have been Joan Salute, manager of NASA's Grapes Project, and Phil Fries, vice president for wine growing at Robert Mondavi Winery. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology with Dr. Moira Gunn. Cliff Brooks is product manager for Microsoft's new mouse. Moira was able to speak with him about the development of this new technology.
Microsoft sold $250 million worth of its old mouse last year. What were the problems with the old mouse?
Well, the old mouse didn't have any problems. This is kind of a lot of interesting questions. If it's not broke, why fix it type situation. But really what sort of started the project off was that we traveled worldwide and talked to users about what they wanted that would enhance their Windows software experience. And a lot of the feedback we got from them was basically what drove the new project.
What was that feedback?
Well, what we basically heard sort of universally was users were aware of this, I'll call it buzzword of ergonomics, and they also asked for comfort and to enhance Windows to make it more productive or faster. And that's pretty much the universal thing that came back from people as we talked to them.
We've talked on this show about how prolific Windows is. It's at 25 million users or so worldwide, and everyone needs a mouse to point to all the icons and click and that type of thing. You don't need a Microsoft mouse to use Windows, right?
That's correct. Windows could actually be, there are keyboard commands that, you know, one could work in Windows with. I think a mouse enhances it and makes it a lot more effective, especially for the first-time computing user. It's significantly more enjoyable to use a mouse with Windows.
For sure. Now, what's the difference between this new Microsoft mouse and the old one?
Well, the new one specifically is shaped fairly differently. It feels.
I have before me both mice.
Okay. So you can see the both the way it would feel is very different. The aesthetic content is, again, very different. The mouse itself, in terms of the basic types of technology that control a mouse, is very similar to the existing mouse.
Now, this one has it's sort of a curve with a big, sort of a, I want to say a teardrop at the end. Why was this?
Well, what we did focus groups on different designs and shapes and found that that aesthetic appeal of our new product was of interest to more people, that it's a very low involvement category where people just pick a mouse. And with this particular design, it elicited a lot of response from people as they looked at different designs. It also was very focal to the ergonomic and comfort research that we put into the design.
Now, you worked with a number of outside consultants, among them the Department of Kinesiology, the University of Illinois. Is this typical for Microsoft to work with academic partners and other consultants?
Within the hardware group at Microsoft, which is a little bit of a unique breed, I think, it is. When we were going kind of into new turf for us, which was really this whole science of ergonomics to really try to define it, what it was, how in the heck would you apply that to a product like a mouse, and then to try to build some data and user testing behind it.
How did you test the system?
It was a very unique process. We had multiple levels of testing, but the one that probably was the most unique was at the design stage of the actual mouse when it was literally a foam block that was hand-carved. we hollowed out the bottom of the mouse. We put a digital puck in there, modified an optical light board. We also wrote a simulated Windows test program so you could actually use this foam block to move a cursor around a screen. And then we put digital force transducers on the fingertips and the palm and actually tested the mouse and simulated Windows tasking. It was a really different type of usability test than would have normally been done for a mouse design.
This is pretty interesting. Now, let's kind of break down what you said. First of all, you made your mock-up was made out of foam, sort of a hard foam, I assume you can carve from. And for those of you who have seen some fancy mice and some not-so-fancy mice, this is a two-button mouse that we have here, and usually, well, of course, everybody uses it differently. I use my index finger and my middle finger for this. When you say you put force sensors on the fingertips, so you were trying to see how much force was applied for all the fingers that were used?
Well, basically, yeah. If I can back up just
sure.
a little bit, we developed a pretty extensive list with a separate consultant, the Joyce Institute. These are folks that do a lot of office computing ergonomic type stuff, and they're located in Seattle. And we developed a long list of ergonomic criteria that if we had the quote-unquote ultimate mouse design, I guess you could call it, it ought to do these types of things. And we literally wanted to try to measure the force data in different parts of the hand. So we started with these force transducers on the fingertips, or what's known as distal control areas. We then put them behind the knuckle ridge, which is also, I guess, in ergonomic technology or terms called the metacarpal phalangeal ridge.
I love it when you talk this way.
and then we put it on...
This is science, right.
This is ergonomics.
I know that science talk.
Right. Ergonomics in the 90s. And then we put it on the fleshy part of the palm. And the basic theory of our ergonomic design behind the whole mouse should be sort of threefold. One, that you could approach the mouse from behind and take the fleshy part of the palm, which is just above the wrist, and actually anchor that, that's called anchoring, according to ergonomics, behind the mouse itself. Move the hump on the mouse far toward the back or back toward your wrist so that the support behind the knuckle ridge would be maximized, and then to extend, lengthen the mouse from there forward to extend the fingertips flat on the mouse. And keep a narrow front end of a mouse so that the ring finger, or the third finger, and the thumb can do what's called a pinch grip to move the mouse more accurately.
As you're describing this, I'm doing this with this mouse, and I'm getting the picture. Of course, I'm the only one. I'm the only one with a mouse in their hands, a new Microsoft mouse in their hands at this time. But I see what you're saying. I mean, I just kind of come from behind with that fatty part. Having used mice for years and years, I never realized what I was doing with it. Mm-hmm. It's like that's sort of how you orient it, and then you kind of grab it. But once you see that big hump in the middle, you kind of lay your palm on it, and then you kind of stretch
it
out.
It's kind of a visual cue for where your hand ought to go on the product.
Yeah.
And basically rolling then back to all those crazy digital force transducers that were on the hand in the usability test, if that were our ergonomic criteria, then we literally wanted to measure the pressure at those different points on the hand and in the palm to see if indeed these different carved designs were getting the right kind of force patterns, distributing the weight accurately. Mm-hmm. And that's what we did. So we actually ended up, I think it was over 90 different hand-carved models to get to this design based on that force data.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Dr. Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Cliff Brooks, product manager for Microsoft's new mouse. I've got small hands, and my husband has huge hands, and this mouse feels pretty good to me. How can this device be good for both of us? I mean, is there a standard hand you design the product to?
Yeah, that's a great question. Actually, in product design, what our designers took sort of as a profile, again, based on ergonomic criteria, is an ANSI standard, or I guess American National Standard Institute. And this design is designed toward a 5 percentile North American female hand size up to a 95 percentile North American male. And those are what product designers try to design products to.
My husband won't be surprised because he's definitely beyond the 95 percentile.
Okay.
We'll have to have him try it.
He'll be a good test for us.
That's right. Now, another thing he would test, he wouldn't be surprised at. I'm making him sound like the odd man out here. How does it support both right-handed and left-handed use? Because this has a definite curve to the right as I'm holding it here.
Right. It definitely has a visual design bias. And in fact, there's a pretty strong perception amongst a number of right-handed users that it's for a right-handed usage because it has that visual twist, which would sometimes show a right-handed user where their thumb might go.
Yeah, your thumb is right in the little curve here.
Correct. Actually, worldwide, the testing that we've done on it, it's about even for left and right-handed preference, which has been really exciting for us. I guess the way we would define ambidextrous product design like that would be safe, comfortable, and effective for either hand in use. And we tested usability in both. And there's a couple things on left and right-handedness that we could tackle. It's kind of a long story.
Go ahead. the left-handed people deserve some time.
Absolutely.
Here.
And in fact, there was a lot of effort put into that to try to understand how left-handed people use their hand and if there are differences from right-handed people. And we actually had four hand PhDs. Involved with this crazy project.
PhDs in hand.
That's right. And we asked them to try to understand better the left-handed usability of a mouse and found, first of all, to start that at a high level, some interesting statistics about left-handed mousing, of all crazy things. But left-handed people are somewhere in the 10 to 11% of the population, and that's defined probably by how they write, writing left-handed. Mm. And in terms of computer use with a mouse, about 50% to 70% of those worldwide, it's interesting there's no real difference worldwide, actually use a mouse on the right side of the computer. So we basically identified that somewhere around 95% of computer users will use a mouse on the right side of the computer. There are a small percentage of right-handed people that will use a mouse on the left, and that's if they're 10-key punch or something like that, 10-key pads, that type of thing. But basically, net-net, it's right-handed usage. So we really spent the time to understand the 5% that do use it on the left. And with this design, while you see a strong visual design bias, the concepts of hand plane support, extended fingers, pinch grip at the front end, for accuracy in a Windows type or a GUI environment.
GUI is the graphical user interface,
right? Exactly. And then another concept that's pretty fundamental toward what we call neutral hand posture is one of, it's called supination, or when your hand likes to tilt a little toward the pinky.
So
if
you put
your hand out on the surface of the table and let it lie in a relaxed, natural posture, it'll tilt just a little toward the pinky. And the spherical shape at the back end of that mouse basically allows the left and right-handed user to have that happen.
If I look at the two buttons, one of the buttons is larger than the other, and I usually use, if I was to say most of the time, I'm using my index finger on the larger button. If I'm a left-handed person, then my index finger would be on the smaller button and my middle finger would be on the middle button. Is that a problem?
Well, that's one way a left-handed user might use that particular design. No, that's not a problem, because in the software we allow you to switch the polarity of the switches to make the right switch the primary button and the left switch the secondary.
So you can just switch it like
correct.
That.
Correct.
All right.
And that's something that most people that manufacture two-button mice would do. We also found kind of an interesting statistic in left-handed usage is what ergonomists call a slightly different toolkit for left-handed writers, or how left-handed people use products. There's a small percentage of left-handed people, as you notice, you've watched left-handed people write where their hand and wrist is actually curved around so they can see what they wrote and not smear ink.
Mm-hmm.
They'll actually take that product, come across to the left button, or what's usually the primary button for right-handed people, and hold it almost at a side grip. And it's a much more comfortable grip. And one of the issues in using a product like that with a left hand is that the mouse would no longer be oriented directly toward the screen.
Mm-hmm.
So if you moved your mouse toward the screen, the cursor wouldn't go up. It would go sideways.
Oh, that's right.
So we've actually allowed for a user to use the mouse in any configuration or orientation toward the screen that they choose and adjust the cursor to move up depending on what their use is.
Well, my left-handed 6'7" husband thanks you.
He'll be the ultimate test.
Yeah. If you can fit him, I won't fit. So we're the swing of the pendulum here.
Okay.
As we have it. How many versions of the, I think you mentioned this, how many versions of the mouse were there before the final version?
This actually is technically the fifth version of the Microsoft mouse we've had since we got into the business in 1983. But actually, in terms of what's known worldwide and what consumers would be aware of, it's really the second version. The original mouse that most people would be familiar with is what has been known sometimes, nicknamed the Dove Bar product, or the original white mouse. And this really is the second major change for most that most people are aware of.
During testing, was there anything that you thought was a good idea that turned out to not be such a good idea?
Actually, I think basically one of the things that we learned in usability testing, which was of interest to us and definitely affected the design, was this whole concept of hand plane support balanced with usability, i.e. moving the cursor around a screen and making it more accurate.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something we really learned, that to achieve the two was basically a balancing act.
So if you could get more accuracy, quite often you lose the comfort on the other end.
That's correct, or hand plane support. If you were to use just the generic ergonomic concepts of using larger muscle groups to move a product around, which is to put your hand flat on an object and let it support the hand completely, and then use your upper muscle groups up toward the shoulder to move the product around a desk, you would lose the fine types of controls that are required in a Windows environment. So we actually had to try to design something that would balance those off.
Do people normally have their elbows on a desk, or say their forearms on a, leveraged as they move things around?
Well, actually, in a lot of at least a lot of the workspace environments that we looked at around the world, as we sort of tested how people use mice and did videotape analysis of that. It's like watching paint dry, I guess, for some people. Actually, a lot of times the workspace was fairly close to the edge of a desk, and so only just a portion of the under the forearm would be on the desk, and the rest would actually be in air.
Really?
Uh-huh.
Interesting. How does this relate to all the concerns we heard of carpal tunnel syndrome?
Well, carpal tunnel syndrome is one of this is one of the generic family of issues that come out of repetitive stress injuries, sometimes known as RSIs, which has gotten a lot more play in the media these days. RSIs basically are anything that's caused by doing something continually over and over and over. And a mouse is something where we haven't seen any indication where RSIs or carpal tunnel syndrome are specifically tied to mouse usage.
So that's interesting. I would have thought that there was some relation, but that it hasn't been.
There isn't any scientific data that show that. It seems to be, at least in the computing workplace, some of those seem to be more oriented toward a lot of repetitive things like keyboard type things and all. It's still a fairly new area, so it's clearly at this point not as much is known about it as related to the computing environment.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Dr. Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Cliff Brooks, product manager for Microsoft's new mouse. I understand that we'll be seeing this new Microsoft mouse automatically packaged in some manufacturers' computer systems. Will it say Microsoft? Or?
Actually, in most cases, it will probably have the Microsoft logo on the mouse and look very similar to the one that a person would buy in the retail store.
If you bought a system and it didn't have such a mouse, and we've kind of described it, but you'll have to go see a picture somewhere eventually, can you upgrade to this mouse?
You could, certainly, because the product's so readily available in the retail reseller market, and basically it's very widely distributed, so one could easily go to a computer or hardware or software store and upgrade to this.
Okay, so the Microsoft mouse goes with just about any IBM-type clone.
Correct, IBM-compatible PC, right.
Now, will you continue to be selling the old mouse?
For a period of time, we will keep a limited version of the old mouse around, yes.
If you have an old mouse, do you get a deal on a new mouse?
Currently, we don't have a marketing program for that.
I'm always looking for the deal.
That's right.
We liked you before. Now.
There is a lot of interest in that. One of the things that we have done for owners of the old mouse is that you can actually upgrade to this new software version 9.0. That it's a new software driver plus some Windows utilities. And that you can upgrade.
Obviously, you can change the software at Microsoft on the software package Windows. you developed the hardware design, and you made some changes in software design as well. What changes did you make in the software design with the new mouse?
Okay. The software driver that comes with this is now called version 9.0 of the software driver. And what we did really differently in it was kind of rolling back to what users were talking about and saying, hey, make Windows easier, make Windows more productive. I guess a lot easier said than done. And Microsoft has a slogan of making it easier and something that we all try to do, and it's, as I said, easier said than done. We put four new specific features that enhance Windows for what we call sort of the mainstream Windows user. And to describe those features, one of them is called Snap To. And any time that a user, if this feature is enabled, it's in the mouse manager screen, you enable that feature, anytime you execute any file command that would generate a dialog box within any Windows application, the cursor would automatically snap over to the dialog box, to the default button in that dialog box. So an example of that would be, let's say a user goes up to the file command with their cursor, says file, pulls it down, says file print. You'd click on print. Normally you'd want it to print, but lo and behold, a dialog box would pop up halfway across your screen, and you'd have to move your mouse over, your cursor over, click on OK for it to actually start printing. In this case, the cursor will snap to the OK button in the dialog box. And that would happen in any Windows application that generates dialog boxes, which is very consistent.
It's at least a second with the, you know, in around there of
right.
How long it takes you to get it over, because you don't know where you were when you started out with it.
Correct. And the rationale behind that and trying to marry it to a hardware product like this new shape and design is, one, use your mouse less, and two, make Windows more productive. Another example of some of the new software features that would ship with this new mouse is a feature called Magnify, and that's when you actuate this feature in any document in any Windows application. You basically would take like a 6-point font and blow it up to about a 30-point font in about a 2x2-inch square on your screen, and as you move your mouse around, that whole area is enhanced, so you can sort of move your cursor pixel by pixel within a screen. And that's a nice productivity feature for trying to insert that crazy I-beam between two L's and a typo, or possibly like in a desktop publishing application where you're cutting and pasting and trying to get an exact photo cut out of a document. So graphic designers, that type of thing.
Now, that does that for Windows. Will it do it on any other applications you've got working on the system?
Any Windows-capable application, these features will work in.
So you get an automatic magnify, then, on any of the applications you have, as long as they're Windows-compatible.
Yes, correct, if this feature within the mouse driver is enabled. Right.
Great. There are several others, other software changes as well, right?
Yeah. Oh, one of the things we found users had a time with, especially in the laptop environment, is finding their cursor. And I don't know if you've ever experienced it, but you can come back from lunch and where did that crazy thing go?
Especially with the bigger screen.
Right, exactly. And, so we found it sort of at the desktop on the large screens, and we found it on the laptop, you know, losing that cursor. And we'd seen people mousing around furiously with their arm trying to find their cursor. So this is just a simple feature. When it's enabled, again, you actuate a hotkey and maybe your right mouse button. You program, it's programmable to what you want. And it'll snap your cursor, even if it's hiding behind a border, right to the center of the screen. So in any Windows application, again. And then another feature is called Screen Wrap. And in Screen Wrap, if you look at kind of how people really use their computer and how do they where do they spend their time with a mouse and their cursor? A lot of time you'll find people in the bottom right-hand corner of their monitor with their cursor on the down scroll button in electronic mail, in Word documents, as they pull down a document. And when they're done, the design or the user interface of most Windows applications is that you would run to the upper left corner from the bottom right corner, the furthest diagonal reach you could run with your mouse. And you'd click on a very small file command to either close that document, save it, whatever. Well, we would allow the user to just tick the mouse cursor off the bottom right of the screen, and it would actually come in automatically at the upper left portion of the screen. So basically, we've trained the software not to recognize any screen borders.
And that's so what that if you're moving to the right, let's say across a lawn, you're trying to, and you go a little too far, you'll show up on the left.
Correct. And that same would be true top and bottom.
Now, does that really work very well?
It can be actually a really...
Not intuitively obvious to me.
That's right. It definitely is a feature that takes some getting used to. It could be very frustrating for the user because you're used to moving your mouse, hitting a border and dropping it down, whereas this case the thing would just keep wrapping and wrapping and wrapping. So it's after you get used to that feature, I think it adds a lot of productivity and allows you to move your mouse less, basically. It's also kind of a neat feature we found for portable input devices, like the integrated trackballs that ship on a lot of the laptops today, and the ballpoint type products that are clip-on products for portable computing.
In those cases, the working the trackballs in those, whether they're small trackballs or big trackballs, when you want to get to the other end of the screen or up the screen, you really do have to lift your hand up a number of times to do that.
Correct.
And so I can see where you might find that to be a big advantage. But you could turn off the screen wrap.
Correct. All of the features I've just described are just a simple click on your mouse button, either on or off, and you don't need to be in this screen called Mouse Manager to use those features. Once you've set them, they work anytime you need them.
Now, Microsoft consulted with Dr. Bryce Rutter, principal of Metaphase Design, which is an independent design firm, and he states, "We tested Microsoft's new mouse design against the leading competitors and observed better window-based computing performance and superior hand compatibility to all other pointing devices." How do you measure better window-based computing performance?
Okay. Well, that was, as I said earlier, is a real important part of this whole project for us. Again, after all, making Windows easier with our hardware products is sort of important for us as a hardware group within a software company. And that was this whole notion of writing simulated Windows software during the design stage and actually measuring time and distance to different icons. So what we did in the software, in the test software we wrote different amplitudes, short and long amplitude, meaning different distances to move the cursor to different icons in the different quadrants of a screen. We had double clicking, and we measured error rates on that. We had menu pull downs. We had people insert I-beams and fix a word within a sentence and highlight different portions of a paragraph. So we really did fairly detailed Windows usability testing actually in the design phase and measured basically time, distance, and speed accuracy.
So measuring how fast it takes you to get places and do a lot of the standard tasks, the new mouse with the new driver, which gives you all those new software options or usability options, actually came out faster.
Well, actually, at the usability testing level at the Department of Kinesiology in University of Illinois, it was literally just a straight hardware comparison. It was one hardware design versus our old mouse, the existing Dove Bar, which we used as a benchmark, and some competitive designs. And basically, the design and hardware alone does make a significant difference.
Moira's guest has been Cliff Brooks, product manager for Microsoft's new mouse. This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen, with original music composition by San Francisco Songwriters. Distribution is handled by Larry Goldberg, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Your interview host is Dr. Moira Gunn. If you'd like a cassette tape or transcript of this broadcast, or to receive a complete program catalog, call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. send your written comments to TechNation, Americans and Technology, Post Office Box 590-607, San Francisco, California, 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. For TechNation, this is Mike Amatori. TechNation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.